But I think one of the things that's missing from this discussion is, in the work of Fothergill and Beattie on incapacity benefit, they for a long time talked about incapacity as being essentially a labour market problem. You solve the labour market problem, you'll solve the problem of incapacity. And more recently, they've begun to recognise that, in fact, it is more complicated than that, and that what you've got in places like South Wales and the North East of England are situations in which people have not only in a situation where opportunities to work are limited, but they're also in a situation where they've become de-skilled and incapacitated in a more social and economic sense for engagement with the labour market. And it seems to me that, in a sense, what we need to do in thinking about incapacity and the future of work is to take a bit more of a historical perspective. And here's a quote from a pretty ancient report by the Coalfields Task Force in 1998, where they looked at the coalfields in particular. It's not just the coalfields, it's also docks, former steel communities, and so on. And they said that we've been left in no doubt about the scale of deprivation and decline. But what makes the coalfields special is the context in which this decline has taken place. They have a unique combination of concentrated joblessness, physical isolation, poor infrastructure, and severe health problems. And I think that sense of that combination tends to get lost in much of the discussion on why it is that certain areas have high rates of incapacity claimants and what it is that prevents them from working. We have our indices of multiple deprivation, and it is an issue of multiple deprivation. I think that quote reminds us of the complex nature of the situation that people find themselves in. And again, sorry, it's a rather long quotation, but I think this is a very powerful one from some work that Hugh Bynum, our former head of school, and his colleagues did on the coal fields, where they were talking particularly about South Wales, but you could relate it equally to parts of the west of Scotland, where they say it was not just a case of localised economic decline, but rather one of cultural crisis. The collapse of coal mining undermined a range of mechanisms of social regulation that were grounded in the politics of the workplace and the trade unions, that spread more widely into local society and politics. There was an acute sense of loss in the places in which coal mines closed after decades of existence. This was typically accompanied by a period of grieving as people in these places tried to come to terms with the manifold implications of the precipitate ending of the economic raison d'etre of their place. Which, when I read this, I found it very interesting, because it seems to me that you could explain rates of incapacity claims very simply. You could simply say the jobs aren't there and people are ill, okay? But I think as social scientists, we need to kind of begin to try to unpack what that means in relation to that regional distribution of incapacity that I was talking about before. And it does seem to me, I remember when I first came to Cardiff in about 10 years ago, must have been about 2002, I went to a meeting of a former coal field support group, and I remember a man, this is in 2002, I remember a man who was ranting with fury at what Margaret Thatcher had done to the coal fields. In 2002, this was. Okay, this is kind of some years after the miners' strike of 1984-85. So I think that slightly soft notion of grief is a very important one. It's important to try to come to terms, I think, with the kind of way in which work and people's responses to so-called opportunities to work have collapsed in certain kinds of places. Now, of course, all of you, not just women here, will recognise a certain kind of gendered nature to this kind of analysis. But what the data that people like Fothergill have got shows is that although the initial increase in incapacity benefit rates was to do with people who'd come out of the coal mines, lost the meaning and purpose of their existence very often through the loss of jobs, it's the same communities where new populations without the skills to get into the employment market have continued to have very high rates of incapacity benefit, and both men and women. So the initial incapacity benefit hike was caused by these kinds of things, where men came out of jobs where they'd worked for years and felt unskilled, unqualified for anything else, and were put on benefits because during the Thatcher period, of course, you remember they were desperately concerned that employment rates shouldn't go too high. So that for the Conservative government in the 1980s, putting coal miners and other workers onto incapacity benefit rather than unemployment benefit was a good policy option because it reduced the employment statistics, which is very important. From the point of view of the people coming onto incapacity benefit, they got paid more on incapacity benefit than they'd get on employment benefit. It saved local employers from having to take on people who might not have been able to work very efficiently anyway. So that there was a kind of win-win-win, really, for government employers and employees. And I think that what this carries with it is a sense of what's happened to these communities over time, which I think gets lost in some of the discussion. Here I've got a couple of quotations from interviews that we did with people at the time of the closure of the steelworks in Edward Vale, where you can see I'll choose one of them to read. I'll read the second one. Closure has always been a threat. My father-in-law worked there in the 1930s. He said they always said it was going to shut and it never has. And so they automatically think that it's never going to happen. It's always been said, but it's never happened. Now I think the community is a bit shocked. So I became very interested in this kind of Durkheimian idea of communities unravelling in a sense of loss and grief in response to the taking away from communities of the single industry that very often had employed most of the people living in the community and therefore, through the multiplier, provided wealth for other businesses to come and work in the area. So the idea of a community unravelling, I think, is a very important one to think of as background to understanding the way in which incapacity is regionally unequal. That's just repeating what I've said about the win-win-win of incapacity benefit. But since the Blairite governments of before, in the years of the Blair governments, there was an increasing emphasis on targeting incapacity claimants to get them into work. And so that idea of allowing incapacity to exist as a convenient win-win-win for everyone became shattered. And of course, the reason for this was, if you can think back to those pre-recessionary times, there was something called almost full employment. So for the Labour government at that time to have all these millions of people on incapacity benefit when there was full employment was something that they felt they ought to deal with. The sad and, to my mind, quite absurd situation we're now in is that even yesterday, David Cameron was saying they were going to continue with this attempt to get all these battered old crocs back into the workforce, in spite of the fact that one in five of 16 to 24-year-olds are now unemployed. The policy contradictions are breathtaking. But you could see how there was some logic to this at the time of the Blair government prior to the recession, the downturn, and the austerity measures that we're now facing. But I think that the other thing to take out from what I'm saying, I haven't expressed it perhaps very well, is that both illness and jobs are much more complicated than politicians like to lead us to believe. You know, if you take someone, taking the illness side, I'll come to this in a minute, but taking the illness side of it, when people have, I don't know, rheumatoid arthritis, diabetes, heart disease, chronic obstructive airways disease, any of those kinds of things, are illnesses which often fluctuate. Some days you'll be able to do things, other days you won't. So illness is more complicated. They can easily be ticked off in an incapacity assessment test. But also the job market. People talk about jobs as if a job was a good thing. And in fact, you know, werk macht frei, as they had over the concentration camps, has almost become the motif of our governments, that they're saying that work is good for you. It'll liberate you. Okay? But of course, what kind of work? And if you look at most of the analyses of what's called precarious employment, this is a good quote, I think, because it really kind of hits it home. Job insecurity is no longer a mere temporary break in an otherwise predictable work-life pattern, but rather a structural feature of the new labour market. And whereas the institutional structure of the post-war labour market privileged security as a means of tapping the most productivity of workers, the flexibility regime gives primacy to insecurity. In other words, the emphasis now is on creating insecurity as an incentive for people to work. Now, what would you do if you'd been safely and cosily cutched up, as we say in Wales, on incapacity benefit for a number of years? If someone offered you a job that was paid only maybe a little bit more than your benefit, if that, that was insecure, that involved you in doing tasks that are maybe hard or unpleasant in some kind of way, would you want to work in a meatpacking factory? I wouldn't. So that it seems to me that that idea of a job is good is something that needs to be unpacked. And the kind of work people are now being asked to do is work in which insecurity is the name of the game, and that's what supposedly keeps people on their toes. So it seems to me that both for the health reasons and the economic and employment reasons, it's not just a question of people working harder. You know, this idea that if incapacity claimants look for work and equip themselves with work, they'll find work is arrant nonsense. And it seems to me, for my final slide, that we do have a big question to ask here. You know, when I do a lot of research work of different kinds in the heads of the valleys, and there are enormous numbers of people there who are actively engaged in work. They're not paid for it. They may or may not be claiming benefit, but they're doing very fundamental forms of work in their communities, looking after older people, looking after the children, running a community centre, no pay, all those kinds of things. So it seems to me that we have to begin to address what are the work and employment needs of people in those communities, particularly people who might not be well enough to engage with the flexible labour regime that job markets now have, but who want to participate in work in a different kind of way. I heard one of my colleagues, Finn Bowring, talking about Hannah Arendt, the philosopher's distinction between labour and work recently, where labour is something that people do because they're forced to do it, and work is something that people do and they get some satisfaction out of it. And it seems to me that in a way, in Wales, I think what we have to come to terms with in Wales is the fact that we are going to be a low-growth, underemployed society. Okay? We are not going to compete in the global labour market. And the implications of that for what kind of work we should support and fund in different kinds of ways, and how we can make use of people who might be unfit for the traditional labour market but wants to do something, is something that's a fundamental question to address. And I think our politicians today seem unable and maybe unwilling to address the kind of big issue. The big issue, I think, is still for Beveridge, as for us, as Tony Judt says, something wider. Simply the question of under what conditions it is possible and worthwhile for men and women as a whole to live. You've got to remember when Beveridge was writing this, okay, and he was talking about men, but we talk about people to live. What is it that creates the conditions which is possible and worthwhile for people to live? And that book by Tony Judt, who died last year, a political writer, Ill Fares the Land, is an excellent kind of overview of some of the kinds of big issues around social democracy and the nature of work and people's demand, which I think is worth reading. I'll stop. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gareth. That was really interesting. I'd like to open the floor for any questions that people might have. Lee?
Hey, thanks, Gareth. It's someone cutting across the whole conference for me now. We'll take a session two as well. The first two speakers, particularly the first one this afternoon, and now what you were saying, has been this whole idea of redefining what we class as work. I mean, it's coming up time and time again. And I was going to ask Ruth earlier, but I didn't get a chance to. Was that people like Bill Jordan argue a policy solution to this is a basic income? And I wonder if you had any comments on that sort of policy approach.
I don't know that literature by Bill Jordan very well, because well, we all cross multiple kind of fields of knowledge, but I don't know that literature very well. But I certainly think that if by that he's meaning that you know, we need to think about how we value and reward in economic terms things that people do at a level that allows them to live in the kind of way that Beveridge was talking about, then I'm entirely in favour of it. How it would work fiscally, I mean, how it would be managed as a financial policy, I'm not entirely sure. But I think, you know, I just think that the idea of pulling women in particular out of the communities in, say, South Wales, where they're supporting granny, looking after kids, helping to run the local community centre, in order that they should go and work in a call centre in Cardiff and have to travel there and back every day and pay maybe for somebody to look after their kids, is madness. It doesn't make any sense at all. And it seems to me that the question of valuing what people are doing is very important. You know, we know there are some people who are not doing anything, and for whatever reason, right? But I mean, from my experience of many of these communities, which are often vilified as communities where nobody does anything, in fact, people are doing lots and lots of things for nothing. And it seems to me that some kind of basic income that acknowledges that work and rewards it, maybe in combination with some kind of benefit to top things up, or however it would work, does seem to me to be an important way forward for policy. I think there is. I mean, you might not, you know, it seems to me there is. I mean, the levels of ill health in, you know, Glasgow in the west of Scotland and South Wales are considerable. And we know that. We know that health inequalities are huge, and that the most unequal areas have enormously high rates of ill health. And indeed, in parts of west of Scotland, life expectancy is falling among certain groups in the population, often for very particular reasons to do with drugs and alcohol. But it seems to me that, you know, I think there are challenges for us in recognising what ill health means. You know, it isn't just somebody's had a leg cut off and they can't walk. It's that people are unable to manage in different kinds of ways. And, of course, where you've got a kind of low skills society where people haven't had access to educational opportunities, the confidence to be able to address opportunities in the labour market just doesn't exist. I mean, I was up in the Gurness Estate in Merthyr recently talking to a group of women there, and they were women who'd had various kinds of problems. They'd been knocked about by various male partners. They left school at the age of 15, 16, never had the opportunity to do anything. Maybe had a couple of kids early on, you know, to talk to them about somehow being able to enter the job market was simply impossible. Now, they may not actually be people who you would say, yes, this person's clinically depressed, but it seems to me that a lot of them did have levels of depression, anxiety, phobia, all kinds of stuff, which would make any sort of movement into the labour market, as the government talks about it, virtually impossible. So I think illness is important. It might not be the kind of fundamental driver of incapacity benefit, but it is a fundamental feature of it, certainly.
David.
I've not got a question. I just wanted to really have a strong feedback on the points. In my own work,
it's always welcome. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, meaninglessness is a kind of major problem. And it leads people to get very ill.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's at a kind of community level or individual level, it destroys things. That sense that there's no meaning or purpose in our community anymore, or my own life, you know, those are things which are fundamental to poor health and people's ability or lack of it to be able to engage. And not just engage in employment, but engage in the kinds of things we desperately now need people to be engaged in, like getting involved again in politics at whatever level, you know, and involved in doing things to try to buffer the horrific effects of an economy that's been completely mishandled by this government and the previous one. And it seems to me that there are people there who, in these communities, who are not working, who would do that work. But they can't, because as soon as they're doing anything, they're expected to kind of, you know, come off, in the case of people who are on benefit, come off benefit and get a job, which is a job that will contribute nothing to their local community or to their own health and well-being, very often.
Jenny, you're possibly the last one, but we might also have time for Jess.
Yeah, just something to ask about if you were aware of any research that's going on to look at the impact on people's health through sort of reassessment with the migration from RMB. I know on the Department of Work's patient consultation site, you know, people were writing in and they were coming to the site and all sorts of stuff.
I would email Tina Beattie. She will definitely know. I don't know if she'll be in on it. Maybe Catherine Nice as well at York. I don't know if they will, but they tend to... They're very pally with the DWP, so they'll probably know.
Yeah.
Jeff? Oh, did you not? Was there someone there with a hand up? Well, I think that's the ideal place to leave it. Thank you very much, Gareth.
Thank you.